We're on.
Okay, let it rip. Good. I thought we'd never get there.
The word minimalist has been, and minimal music has been used to describe your work. Did you ever like that term, and do you think it ever has applied or applies now?
That's a question that gets asked from time to time. And I have to keep giving the same answer because it's the best one I can come up with. Debussy, Ravel, Satie, Kirkland were impressionists. And Schoenberg, Berg, and Rayburn were expressionists. And myself and Glass and Riley and Adams and other people on Lamont Young are minimalists. All those terms come from the visual arts. All those terms were applied to composers who didn't like the terms that were being applied to them. And none of those composers had anything to say about it. I think the word minimal, so far as I can pin it down, was coined by Michael Nyman, the English musician and critic, in about 1970. And, of course, he or anybody else who was using it was thinking about painters and sculptors like Sol LeWitt and Don Judd and Frank Stella, minimal artists. So it fits hand in glove with those other musicological terms taken from painting and applied to music. As far as a descriptive term goes, it probably ceases being descriptive of my music after drumming. Music for Marilyn Instruments, voice and organ, certainly music for 18 musicians, certainly Tehlim, and with the desert music it's almost a joke, could not be called minimal. But they will be called minimal long after I'm dead, I suppose, because that has become the journalistic and music historical handle. As a handle, you know, it's fine to pick up all those names with one word, and I can understand the convenience. As a description, I think it's good about up to 1971.
Early on in your music career, you moved away from classical tradition. What made you want to get away from that?
Well, you know, it wasn't phrased in the negative inside of me. It wasn't like, you know, the time has come for a historical change, he said, with his finger to the wind. When I was 14 years old, I had, as a younger child, taken piano lessons, played simplified versions of Haydn and Mozart, listened to the Beethoven symphonies, the unfinished Symphony of Schubert, the Richard the Meistersinger, all the nice middle-class classical favorites. At the age of 14, for the first time, I heard the Brandenburg Concertos, The Rite of Spring, and Charlie Parker, Miles Davis, and Kenny Clarke. And I immediately started studying drums because I thought Kenny Clarke was the greatest drummer I'd ever heard in my life. And I became interested in these musics, which I had not heard. Now, if you were a child of 14, or whatever you are, an adolescent of 14, and you were moved by that kind of music, it might very well turn out that as a music student later on in your life, after going through Juilliard and Mills College, it might be that someone like that might not care for the music of Stockhausen, Boulez, Berio, and Cage, which doesn't have a rhythmic profile where you could keep any steady beat going, which doesn't have a clear tonal center. Schoenberg said, you'll whistle my tunes 50 years after my death, the postman will whistle, and it's 100 years, and no postman is whistling Piero Lunaire or anything else. So I simply was trying to find a place for myself to really be engaged, and I didn't find it in the academic world of my studies at that period of time. So I, for that reason and for other reasons, decided I would not look for academic employment. When I graduated as a graduate student from Mills College with a master's degree in 1963, my next stop was the Yellow Cab Company in San Francisco. And my next stop after that was the Rincon Annex Post Office in San Francisco, because I didn't want to get a job teaching harmony and theory and composition where I felt my energies would be drained and I would be placed in a context that I was musically uncomfortable in. I was more comfortable going to the jazz workshop and hearing John Coltrane than in sitting in a classroom that was writing and pretending to be engaged in a magic square so you could write compositions that would sound like Boulez's music. Not that Boulez isn't a great composer. He is. But Boulez comes out of post-World War II Europe, putting the pieces together after a bombed-out catastrophe. And I was raised in America of Chuck Berry and Fats Domino and tail fins and beer and McDonald's. It was another world. And I think people come from a time and they come from a place. Beethoven, the good German, you can hear it in the music. You can hear in Schoenberg's music the catastrophe of turn of the century, the Vienna and Berlin. You can feel the rumblings of the cafe going mad, and that's why they're called expressionists. But to pretend in 1958 or 1962 America that you're still living in 1912 Vienna or Berlin is a lie. And I just felt uncomfortable with writing music like that, and therefore moved in the direction of things like John Coltrane, of the Stravinsky that I had loved, of the Baroque music I had loved, of the non-Western music that I had heard and was about to study from Africa and Indonesia. But it was not done as a way to get away from a classical tradition. It was a way to do what I felt was the only thing I wanted to do.
Your early compositions really stripped everything away. And I'm thinking here of like your tape pieces, like Come Out and Show 'Em and It's Gonna Rain.
Or even the instrumental pieces, Piano Phase and Violin Phase.
Yeah, and there was just one phrase repeated over and over on the tape pieces. It weren't even instruments. It was mm-hmm. just one sentence by one voice fed over and over again in different ways
right.
and manipulated by tape.
Mm-hmm.
But why did you want to pare everything down like that in your early work?
Well, I had discovered via the tape pieces, particularly It's Gonna Rain, which is the very first piece in this style, that by taking a tape loop, which is a simply repeating bit of speech, and then by accident I discovered that if you play it against itself, that it will gradually drift away from itself. If you have two machines, two tape loops, they're running at the same speed. You line them up together, but it turns out that the machines are not perfect. They drift apart. And what happens is that you get this slow shift of phase, and a lot of complex musical patterns result from this. Sounds very dry and boring. If you listen to a little bit of It's Gonna Rain or Come Out, you sound it's not that way at all. And what's more, it even seems to elucidate what's being said. Right after those two pieces were over, I went through a kind of a crisis. It's nice, easy to talk about it now, but at the time it was very upsetting. I was thinking, on the one hand, this is a great idea, musically speaking. And number two, it can't be done with people, so therefore it's just an electronic gimmick. And I went back and forth with that for about 6 months, feeling a little bit like a mad scientist trapped in the laboratory. And finally, what I did was I went to the piano, I played a little pattern at the piano, which eventually turned into Piano Phase, made a tape loop of that pattern, sat down at the piano and said, okay, I'm the second tape recorder, let's see. And what I found was that while I couldn't have the obvious perfection of a tape recorder slowly drifting away from another, I could do it. I could start in unison with myself on the tape, gradually increase my tempo until I was finally 1/16th note ahead. And what I also found, to my surprise, was that doing it was very, very exciting. It was very, very focusing. It was like doing a meditational exercise because one did not have to read the notes. To be played were written, yes, but easily memorized, easily put aside, and the musical tasks to be done to move ahead to the next rational relationship, i.e. 1/16th note ahead, was something you simply had to listen with eyes closed to accomplish. So it was in a kind of gray musical area between improvisation and composition. Now, this is back in 1967, but those pieces were a way of proving to myself that this was something that could be done by a performer. The next thing that happened to my great pleasure was that my friend at the time, Arthur Murphy, who was a Juilliard graduate also, and I found two pianos. It was very hard to find two pianos economically in those days. At a little college in New Jersey, Fairleigh Dickinson, we were asked to give, I think, the first concert I ever gave. And the night before, we went out there and tried on two pianos, and it worked. It was like, look, Ma, no tape. And that was the beginning of a sort of rush of energy that continued up to 1971 on drumming, where a lot of pieces were done in this early period. I look back on that period, just as you suggested, as a period of writing what I call now radical etudes. They're like studies in one single-minded rhythmic process, and everything else is put aside. It has to be piano against piano, because if you're playing piano, let's say, and I'm playing harpsichord, and I gradually get ahead of you, it just sounds like some weird, we don't know what, jumble, because the two timbres separate. If I'm playing piano and you're playing piano, or if we're both playing harpsichord, they form one web of sound, and you don't even know, the listener doesn't even know who's playing what. Sometimes the player doesn't remember who's playing what. And it's the overall result that matters. So the choice of timbre was, I picked the instrument, then it must be multiples of that same instrument. And hence, I wrote a lot of pieces in those years for two pianos, two marimbas, four violins, four organs was the name of a piece. Six pianos came in that period of time. And the question of timbre was that one decision, it's going to be so-and-so. It's going to be piano, it's going to be electric organ, whatever it's going to be. And then there were no further decisions to be made. Choices of harmony were also pared down. There would be a certain module, a certain repeating pattern or a chord, as it was in four organs. And then that would simply develop rhythmically. There would be no changes of notes. Now, that's very extreme. But it was necessary for me at the time because I was absolutely maniacally focused on these rhythmic processes.
But paring it down like that gave you a chance to master things
yes.
individually, because they're really complex ideas that
yes.
you're working with. And well, difficult for musicians to execute,
yes.
too.
Yes, and it was at a time when I really was onto something new, and I just automatically, these were not planned, I just automatically did this. Somebody else might have done it otherwise. Starting in about 1971 with the end of drumming, the drumming is in four parts. First part is just for drums against drums, then marimbas against marimbas with women's voices imitating the marimbas, then for glockenspiels against glockenspiels with piccolo and whistling imitating the glockenspiels. But at the end, I felt the very Western necessity of bringing it all together. Fourth movement, finale, take the consequences of what you've set in motion. After drumming, I began to realize, well, here we are in a situation, here I am in a situation where I'm dealing with mixing timbres and possibly introducing more harmonic development. And I would say that in a very real sense, that's what's been happening from 1971 to 1985, bringing everything else back in.
My guest is composer Steve Reich. In 1970, you spent a summer studying drumming at the Institute of African Studies at the University of Ghana. You were in a foreign culture there. What did you want to make sure that you didn't do in terms of how you were going to treat this foreign music and what you were going to borrow from it?
Well, a number of things. That's an interesting way of putting the question. When I went to Africa, it was clear to me that I was going to when I went to Ghana, it was clear to me that I was going to a country where I was the student. At that very same period of time, shortly thereafter, I went to Europe, and I went there, I felt, as a teacher. Because I was focused outside of European musical tradition. And indeed, I was learning things. Now, to make a long story short, what I ended up concluding, and this on very specific, the brief story. I was in Africa, and what I would take daily lessons. I would record the lessons. Lessons were being taught by rote. The teacher plays one pattern, he gives it to you. You play, up, oh, wrong. He gives it back, plays it again, up, oh, still wrong, oh, get back, finally right. And all this is being recorded, so you can go over it later. And I tried to notate it down, which I did, and later published a little article. It was in a book that came out a few years ago. And when I the thing that attracted me the most, and it was also small and portable, were some iron bells that were called gangangs and atokes. And they were used as accompaniment for songs and sometimes as part of the overall musical ensemble. The gangang in particular is a double bell, two sort of cowbells connected, iron cowbells connected at their necks. And it's used as sort of the basic timekeeper. It's like the ride cymbal in jazz. It rides out over the entire ensemble, and it is the instrument to which everybody in the ensemble relates. There is no conductor, but you kind of everybody has to know where they are vis-a-vis the bell if they want to be in the right place at the right time. So I brought back four of these, two of the gangangs and two of the atokes, and I had thought, I'm going to make a piece of this. I didn't know what that meant, but I was going to write my own piece with them. And I put them in heavy iron. I rattled through customs and finally got back. And the more I thought about it, the odder it got. First of all, they're not tuned to our scale. They're tuned roughly in sixths and octaves, but certainly they'd be out of tune. And I thought, well, what am I going to do, take a metal file and sort of get them right? It seemed like right was really rape. It was like a kind of musical distortion. These instruments come from a certain culture. They're tuned a certain way to suit a certain kind of historical context, and I was going to like literally yank them into some other one. So I began to feel increasingly uncomfortable with that. And what I ended up doing was teaching some of the musicians in my ensemble how to play the patterns I'd learned in Africa. It would be like teaching somebody how to play Scarlatti, only it happened to be African patterns. And this served to get the impetus to play it out of my system and out of the system of my friends. And what I concluded from that and from a number of experiences in this direction is that I didn't want to imitate the sound of any non-Western music. The same thing happened later with Balinese music, which is very seductive, very beautiful, shimmering instruments. But that I could learn a great deal from its structure, which is to say that when you're very young, I mean when you're an infant, you hear the do re mi fa si la si do in your cradle, and it goes into your unconscious long before you know about anything. And it's just there. You dream that way. I don't think that foreign scales and timbres travel as easily because we immediately, on some level that's very deep, just know it's not part of the original equipment. On the other hand, even a composer who's trained learns things like sonata allegro form, canon procedure, fugue, at a much later date in their development. If they're very precocious, they might learn it before they were, 10 or 12, but that would be very early. And usually it's done as a teenager. at whatever time it's learned, it's considerably later than hearing scales and hearing instruments, which is very primary. And so what I have concluded and what I have adhered to as a practice is that I have learned some things about how Africans put their music together, polyrhythmic patterns superimposed so their downbeats don't coincide, and similarly in Balinese music. But I would never, ever use their scales, their instruments, or any of their tunes. I would feel like I was trespassing on somebody else's property and I was liable to be caught and thrown in jail. I mean, that's just my superego, but that's how I think of it.
I guess you risk exoticism, too, of using something because it's different.
Yeah, I think that, you know, at a period of time when Debussy heard the gamelan that was from Java, at the there was a French exposition around the turn of the century, he did begin to incorporate gong effects in his music. It would be difficult to condemn Debussy because, first of all, he was a genius, and second of all, at that time, it would have been out of the question to learn how to play those musics. But in our era, that is no longer out of the question. You can go to Wesleyan University and learn how to play gamelan music. And once you can do that, then you begin to relate to it as you would relate to Western music. And you begin to see, well, this has got a tradition. They did this, and now they do that, and these instruments fit in this way and that way. And it is no longer the perfume alone, the what you hear at a distance. I think Debussy reacted very honestly, and it worked well in his music. But I think that many others don't have to name have suffered. I think many American and British popular musicians were absolutely ruined by Indian music, and perhaps some composers who I could name. I think Indian music was the death of them. They became so Indian that, they, in fact, they weren't Indian, they weren't American, they weren't anything, and it was a tremendous loss for all concerned. And I saw that happening around me. I got the impression, I think a very accurate one, these musics are very ancient, they're very powerful. They come from a musical, a religious tradition, and a lot of people just drowned in depths. And I think a modicum of respect and understanding that you're dealing with something that's of great seriousness and goes a long distance, and that you represent a more individual tradition, can perhaps instill a little healthy caution.
Well, several years after you studied African drumming and gamelan music, mm-hmm. you turned to Jewish music, mm-hmm. really, for mm-hmm. inspiration, and you wrote the piece a few years ago to Halim,
right?
Whose text is from
it's the Psalms,
Old Testament
in the original
Psalms.
Hebrew.
Yeah.
No, it's the Psalms.
The Psalms, okay. Well, no, it's just interesting to me. It's interesting to me that you turn to your own religion after traveling to mm-hmm. faraway places
exactly
for inspiration.
So. Right.
Why did you start to turn to Judaism for text and for inspiration?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a very good question, too. You seem to be full of them today and other days as well. I'm not African. I'm not Balinese. And one of the things that I admired while in Africa and while studying Balinese music was the preservation of an ancient tradition, the fear that an ancient tradition could get diluted in its impact with the West. And when those experiences were over, I began to reflect that I was not from those cultures. And where did I have anything as wonderful as that? Did I have any tradition that went back thousands of years? And I thought, well, yes, I certainly do. But I had been raised as a Reformed Jew, i.e. I could have been raised as a Unitarian. I had no knowledge of the Hebrew language. I did not know that the Torah was read in a weekly cycle throughout the year. I was an ignoramus, Jewishly speaking. So at the tender age of 37, I went back and to Lincoln Square Synagogue in Midtown Manhattan, which is extremely, probably the best teaching synagogue in America for adults, and began studying biblical Hebrew and the weekly portion of the Torah. And in the study of the Hebrew language, my teacher, I was working, and he said, well, you know, these are the vowels, these are the consonants. Well, I said, well, what are those other signs? He said, oh, well, that's the musical notation. I said, well, I've got to find out about that. So I ended up going to the Jewish Theological Seminary and finding a woman by the name of Johanna Spector, who's a musicologist who specializes in Sephardic Jewish music, music of Jews living in Arab countries. And through her, I was related to a cantor from New Jersey who I studied with, Edward Berman, just how to do it. He probably taught me a little bit of what was probably a Lithuanian tradition. You look like you might have come from a Lithuanian tradition yourself.
Not exactly Lithuanian.
Oh? Or Polish, perhaps.
Yeah, Polish-Russian.
Me too. Well, in any event, so I studied with him a little bit, and I read a book, which I would recommend to anyone listening, called Jewish Music by Abraham Idelson. Idelson was a contemporary of Bartok's, and Idelson did exactly what Bartok did. He put a Edison phonograph on his back, only when Bartok tramped off to Eastern Europe, Idelson tramped off to the Middle East. And Idelson transcribed cantillation of Jews living in Yemen, living in Iraq, living throughout the Middle Eastern area, and transcribed them in 7 volumes. And what Idelson showed, particularly in the psalm singing of the Yemenite Jews, was that there was an undeniable connection between the way Yemenites were presently singing the psalms in Gregorian psalm tone, as it's been preserved, i.e. that, as we all would suspect, but that now is proved, that Gregorian chant came directly out of synagogue chant in the Middle East, and as it moved west, it became less melismatic and simpler and so on and so forth. All of this was enormously interesting to me. But again, with Tehillim, I think people think I went to Israel and came back and wrote Tehillim, and yes, I did. But Tehillim means psalms. Tehillim means praises. Praises are related to the Hebrew root hey, lamed, lamed, which is the root of hallelujah. And Tehillim means praises, plural, book of praises. Then in Greek became psalmos, and in English psalms. I chose the set psalms because, A, of course, they're the musical text. They're the text that was sung in biblical times. And B, because the tradition for singing them in the Western synagogues is completely lost. If you go into a synagogue in Philadelphia or New York or California and you hear, or Israel, a Western synagogue, and you hear the psalms being sung, you'll hear bad imitation church hymn tunes. Da-da-dee-da-dee-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, which is a very well-known psalm tune and totally ridiculous and irrelevant musical equivalent. But for that very reason, I felt free. There was no – I was going to set the book of Jonah, but the book of Yonah is actually chanted in the synagogue very beautifully on the afternoon of Yom Kippur, and it doesn't need me, and it doesn't need Arnold Schoenberg, and it doesn't need Phil Glass, and it doesn't need George Gershwin or any other Jewish composer to give it anything. The tradition of the synagogue is to maintain an ancient tradition and not to have anything added and not to have anything subtracted, which is in direct contrast to the church, which encourages new masses and new musical additions to the liturgy. So Tehillim is, number one, a composition of mine with no input from cantillation whatsoever, because the Psalms gave me that green light to go ahead and compose without any model. It most definitely works on the rhythm, as I perceive it, of the Hebrew classical psalm text. But that is its one and only connection.
For the music research, you studied, as you said, a lot of Middle Eastern Jewish singing,
right,
which is really different than American and Western European Jewish singing. Do you think that there's any music tradition that holds the Jewish culture together?
Yes, and it is precisely in the cantillation. I mean, what you say, I was in a house of a Yemenite Jew in Jerusalem. He was about 50 or 60. His son was about 20. First he sang, and roughly, it was the beginning of Genesis, it sounded like, and then he said, but you must hear my son. He was like very concerned that I hear him. And the son sang roughly like, Bereshit bara Elokim et hashamayim ve'et ha'aretz. Well, yes, it's different. The voice is different. My notes weren't different, but they were different over there. They were one. The father was singing in the cracks of the piano, and the son was singing right on the notes of the piano. Being brought up with a piano, I sing on the notes of the piano, even if I'm singing through my nose. But the similarity is in the structure. All of Hebrew chant is basically to elucidate a sacred text, and each little motive. Mercha, hatipcha, mercha, sof pasuk. These little, mercha is a certain little melodic movement. Mercha, tipcha, mercha, sof pasuk. The end of the word is elucidating the text. And therefore, all over the world, the notes are different, the sound is different, but the function of how the motives are put together is identical. It's basically punctuation, musical punctuation, making sense of the words.
When you were composing Tehillim,
right,
did it bring you more back into Jewish religion, which you weren't religious before? I don't know if you've become religious since.
Well, I have a religious appetite, let's say. I did meditation during the 60s, and I did hatha yoga, which is not really religious at all, but it was a good exercise, until I hurt my back by standing on my head. So watch out there. If you're standing on your head, see your orthopedic doctor before you continue. But I became, in the course of the studies that I mentioned earlier, studying Torah every week, that was not a musical study at all. It was a religious study. It was in filling in the blanks in my own background. And yes, I have we observe the Sabbath, and I try to avoid concerts on Friday nights. Sometimes we play them if they're necessary, and I've got a great deal out of it.
Do you consider Tehillim to be sacred music? And do you think that music is any more sacred because it has a sacred text?
It's a very good question. The answer from my perspective is no, I do not consider it a piece of religious music. I consider it a piece of concert music. Tehillim will stand or fall as it succeeds in the concert hall. If it's played in a synagogue, that's a curiosity because a synagogue is not a place to play it. As a matter of fact, if it's played in a synagogue, it's probably not a very serious synagogue. it may be a nice place to go to hear music, but I wouldn't go there to pray. And as I say, that is directly related to the fact that the church, in contrast, needs new pieces. The synagogue does not. But to talk about another composer, Stravinsky's Mass is a piece of religious music because it can be and has occasionally been used by the Catholic Church. His Symphony of Psalms is not religious music in the sense in which it could not be used as part of the liturgy. It is a concert piece using a classical religious text, and so is Tehillim.
My guest is composer Steve Reich. You've also used text in your new composition, Desert Music, and the Texas poetry by William Carlos Williams. Why do you? This is the second time you've used text. Mm-hmm. Why are you going now to text and composing music for it?
Because it forces me into situations I could never think of without it. Tehillim. After I chose the psalm text for Tehillim, it's as if they turned around and grabbed me by the scruff of the neck and said, I need a melody. I don't mean a repeating pattern. I mean a melody, capital M. And I found myself being forced to do something that I would not normally do. And frankly, I liked that experience. And I think most composers would. Williams is a very different cup of tea than the Psalms, and so very different results.
You're writing for orchestra now.
Apparently.
When you're writing for your ensemble, you could
still
probably
do that.
But for an ensemble piece, you could probably gather them together and have them perform it, no, while you're writing it? I guess
no,
not.
I could, but I used to in the old days, but they're too busy and too expensive nowadays. Yeah, I can't afford to do that. I got to get my act together before they're there.
Well, how can you really hear what it is you're composing when you're writing for so many pieces?
Well, I sit at the piano. Some people hear it all in their heads. I hear it much better at the piano. Sometimes I'll use the electric organ. Sometimes I'll use the marimba, the vibraphone, whatever's there. I use the electric organ for all the winds and strings that I don't play. The ensemble was always written the same way. Really, there's no difference. What I did with the ensemble in the early days was to rehearse midway through the piece and make changes right then and there vis-a-vis orchestration. I rarely would change music. Occasionally, I'd reject a whole something because it wasn't working, and I would do that in an orchestral piece as well. And I still invite people down, particularly woodwind players in my ensemble, to try things out orchestration-wise for an orchestra piece that's coming up. I don't like to go in and have question marks. I want to go in as carefully prepared as it's humanly possible to be. But really, the mode of composition has not shifted more. It's just there's more work involved in writing for the orchestra. But you should be advised that my two most recently completed pieces are Sextet for four percussion and two keyboard and New York Counterpoint for multiple clarinets played live and on tape.
I see your career somehow as starting off moving away from Western tradition, mm-hmm. and in recently kind of moving back toward it. Is that accurate?
Very accurate. I think that, as we mentioned earlier, there were these very radical pieces at the beginning, and then it was a time about 71, 72, 73 to look around and say, okay, well, what happens if you introduce more harmonic development? What happens if you start using a mixture of instruments? And these are purely Western traditional considerations. They were set aside, and then it was time to say, well, this is clear. These rhythmic procedures are clear, and they haven't gone away. They're my bone structure. But I learned how to walk, and it would have been boring to repeat those pieces over and over again. And the way to keep myself involved was to add these specifically Western concerns, and I suspect that this will continue.
But you're returning to these Western ideas and to certain traditions on your own terms.
I think anybody listening to the Desert Music within 30 seconds would recognize some similarity to music for 18 musicians and possibly drumming.
You and Philip Glass are frequently spoken of in the same breath and compared and everything. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think, tell me what you think, sometimes I think it's not unlike in the 1930s and 40s when people used to argue about who is the king, Benny or Artie, Benny Goodman or Artie Shaw, you know, like, who do you think is better? Do you find that happens all the time, that people are bickering about, you know, who they like best, Reich or Glass?
Undoubtedly, we each have our patrons and those who are our detractors. I don't just mean patrons who give you money. Sure, I mean, that's human nature. I would say it also could be, you know, similar. I mean, on a perhaps a more exalted or less exalted level, I don't know. Debussy and Ravel are, I don't necessarily say this the same, but I think that similar situations, I know that there was a good deal of conflict between Debussy and Ravel. I don't know what Mozart and Haydn's relationship was. Haydn had the advantage or the disadvantage of being a much older man. But these things happen historically. Rauschenberg and Johns.
You started off as friends, right, and worked together?
We were at Juilliard together, and then we both went our separate ways. He went to Europe to study, and I went to California. And in California, I was influenced by Terry Riley's In C, and Riley had been influenced by Lamont Young. I came back to New York and was giving a concert at the Park Place Gallery, which Paula Cooper ran at the time, in Lower Manhattan. And Phil came into one of the concerts. He was back from Europe. He heard what he wanted to show me what he was doing. And in the years between 67 and 68, I influenced him in a way that Terry Riley had influenced me. After that period of time, I think we've all sort of gone our separate ways.
Are you in touch anymore, or do you see each other as competitors?
Well, I am in touch with Riley, and I'm in touch with Lamont Young. I'm not really much in touch with Phil at all.
Is there any animosity there?
I gather so, because I've had to take some actions to stop it.
Really?
Well, there were some notes that were implying that I was a sideman. His ensemble, some other ugly things, and they were in the Einstein on the Beach notes, and they had to be taken out, and they were.
It's interesting that his music has kind of gotten a certain cachet in the rock world, and your music seems to be performed more in the classical world.
Well, I think that there's no question but that he is writing for the theater, and that he's writing for films, and that that is really what he's doing. And I think that you automatically, Berg totally eclipsed Webern in terms of press, because opera simply does that. If you go to music school, you find the opera department has got the most money. The Metropolitan Opera is bigger than Avery Fisher Hall. And that's just a question of dollars and cents and amounts of tons of scenery, etc. I don't think, I really am not interested in the theater. I'm very interested in dance, and there has been a rather considerable amount of dance done to my music, from highlights being Laura Dean and Jerome Robbins. But I'm not attracted to opera as a listener, and it would be unlikely that I would do, I mean, I might do a piece of musical theater somewhere along the line, but I'm not an opera composer with a capital O. And I think that what goes with that is, you know, less prominence in the press and less prominence in the popular world, and I think that that's that's been a standard item since these things have been around. When all things are said and done, I think Webern was taken more seriously than Berg, but in their lifetimes, I'm sure Webern was hardly known.
When you started to compose and realized that that's what you wanted to spend your life doing, mm-hmm. what did you think the chances were that you'd be able to actually support yourself with music?
Well, I was raised in an era that wouldn't ask that question. I was came out of Cornell, which I made the decision in 57. And I don't know if you can imagine such a time. It was the 50s, and they were very conservative. But amongst those who were not part of the middle-class mentality, including myself, there was such an idealism that that question just seemed to be irrelevant. Now, I think it was very foolish, perhaps, in retrospect, especially in the 80s when kids in college are very much aware where they're going to get a job. But it simply wasn't – I mean, I went down, and I took this job, I took that job, and I was that way financially from 57 when I got out of Cornell all the way through graduate school, where I really had to support myself, and up to about 1971 when I started to make a living. And I remember my mother saying to me, you know, why don't you write a few pop tunes to tide you over, dear? And I didn't have any smart aleck answer to say, oh, you know, I mean, I say, well, I'm not very good at that, you know, and leave it at that.
Could you have done it, do you think, written some pop tunes?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm sure I could have written some pop tunes, but I think they probably would have been terrible. I mean, you know, I don't think very much of Leonard Bernstein's pop tunes. I mean, you know, if you want to write pop tunes, you better be Stephen Sondheim. You've got to be born to that. That's a real talent. Richard Rodgers was a great composer, and Stephen Sondheim is a great composer, and George Gershwin is a very great composer. And if you think that anybody could, that's a lesser art form, you're nuts. You have to have that gift. I don't think I have it. I have another gift.
So did you spend several years doing day jobs to support?
Yes, all kinds of day. As I told you, I was a cab driver at one time. I was a postman. I was a social worker. I was, you know, all kinds of. I was a furniture mover. Phil Glass and I had a moving company. It was called Chelsea Light Moving. They gave us all the funky sofas on the Lower East Side to move.
When you started performing, and when your music started to be performed, it was mostly in New York and in the Village and Soho, right, and in galleries and small performance spaces?
Yes, exactly. So particularly under art auspices. I had a lot of friends who were painters and sculptors. As I mentioned, the gallery that we played in was the Park Place Gallery. It was a gallery where people like Robert Smithson, Sol LeWitt showed their sculpture and artwork. And the opportunities I had first off the bat that were major venues were the Whitney Museum, the Guggenheim Museum, the Walker Art Center, the Museum of Modern Art. Drumming was premiered at the Museum of Modern Art and Brooklyn Academy and Town Hall.
What's the connection, do you think, between your music and the visual arts, besides the fact that the word minimalism comes out of the visual arts?
That came later. Well, I'm just someone who was always interested in painting and sculpture and would visit painters, knew them, and hung out in that world. Maybe it was my love of jazz. That was the common meeting ground. I think before my music, let's say, matured, I would go to jazz spots and you would meet people who were painters and sculptors there, filmmakers like Michael Snow, dancers. And before what I did came to pass, I would say that that was the meeting ground where that people who were drawn to jazz were from many of the visual arts and classical music and dance, particularly in the late 50s and early 60s, so that socially, I knew those people, and therefore, when I had something to play, they were generous in offering me either their studios, their galleries, or their connections at museums to encourage them to present my music at the museums.
What were the early responses that you got to your music?
Tremendously popular within those restricted contexts. Whenever the music was yanked out of context, when Michael Tilson Thomas invited me to come to Boston in 1971 to play four organs at Symphony Hall, which we did, which is for four Farfisa screamer rock organs and maracas, it caused a real disturbance. And when he took it to Carnegie Hall in 1973 on a BSO subscription concert, it was just about a riot. There was so much booing and bravoing during the performance that we lost our place and he had to yell out rehearsal numbers.
Did it make you feel like it was your rite of spring?
Well, I was so naive. I keep saying this, but it's true. I was so naive. I was more concerned about that we'd gotten lost and we were messing up. Michael was like crowing, this is a historical moment. I was just worried that, you know, the wires were going to get unplugged. I think in retrospect, it probably had some of that. I never intended the épaté de la bourgeoisie, that kind of slap in the face musically. That's not my way. But I think that when a piece like Four Organs, which is probably the most radical thing, or one of the most radical things they've ever done, was presented to an extremely conservative audience at a time when this style was unknown, I think Michael, carefully did think about this, and it drew a huge response. Again, that same piece played at the Guggenheim Museum for 200 or 300 people who came to hear Steve Reich's musicians would get a standing ovation. It did. So it depended who we were who we're talking about in those days.
How anxious were you to get out of that art scene and reach a broader audience?
Well, everything with me has happened gradually. I'm talking about things that happened in 1971 at the moment, or 73, and they didn't change overnight. There were other, Boston Museum of Fine Arts that we played down here at Moore College in Philadelphia. So again, an art college thing, and we played at the opening of the Berkeley Museum, and then gradually there'd be, because of Michael, perhaps people said, Tilson Thomas did it, and then there was a big piece in the Times when Pierre Boulez said to play at the downtown series the New York Philharmonic was going to give. So these suddenly gave the outside world a view that something was brewing here, that certain very highly respected conductors were taking seriously enough to present, and I think that began the rumbles that led to interest from the musical establishment. I must say, though, in all honesty, that Tilson Thomas was around in those days, so I could have gone to him and say, well, Michael, could you get me a commission with the BSO? I wasn't interested. I wanted to write music for Marilyn and Smith's Voices in Oregon, which I asked him to do and which he did in Boston, six pianos, music for 18 musicians, etc. It wasn't until about 1979 that I really began to feel I want to make it easier for people to play my music. I mean, by that I mean simple questions of hardware. Music for 18 musicians, you need three marimbas, two xylophones, one vibraphone, and four pianos. Well, that's got a lot of people running out the door, just in terms of the expense. So Octet, which was the first piece that was really written with this in mind, is scored for string quartet, two pianos, two clarinets, two flutes, and it's been played hundreds of times around the world because everybody's got the instruments. This was something I liked. It's also, I think, one of the better pieces I've done. And I began to get interested in writing for the particular combinations of instruments that are available to one if you write for the orchestra. It became something interesting to me. I began to see it as an expansion of my own ensemble. I had written music as a large ensemble. My ensemble was getting larger, and I was beginning to feel, well, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to have my own orchestra. That's not what it's about. There's a divide line. 20 musicians, plenty, too much. So if I want to do something larger than that, I've got to deal with the physical realities that they exist pre-made in locations. You go to them, they got everything together, you prepare your score, and it's done. This also was a challenge because I was at a totally different time of my life than when I'd written orchestra pieces as a student. And I had a whole style and way of writing music. So the challenge was to get that into the orchestra. And perhaps one of the most important things about the desert music is that it finally, in a way that Tehillim did not, in a way that Variations did not, solves the problem of how to get my particular style right smack dab into the symphony orchestra and chorus.
How does it solve that problem?
Solves that problem in a number of ways. One of them is purely the placement of human beings. The orchestra is deployed physically a certain way on the stage to play certain kinds of music very well. The one thing I had to do was to move the percussion players, the principal mallet players of marimbas and vibraphones in the desert music, directly in front of the conductor. Now, this is not to do the percussionist revenge, although it's that too. But if the percussion was standing 60 feet or 50 feet in back of the string section on the right or left, and the conductor is in his normal position, and they're playing constantly the true beat of the piece, then what the rest of the orchestra hears, because of the delay, because of the fact the time travel, the time movement of sound is not that fast, is going to be a conflicting beat between what the conductor, what they see of the conductor, and what they hear of the percussion. The only way to put that together is to have the percussion right under the conductor so that one information vis-a-vis the time, the tempo of the piece, is going out unified between the beat of the conductor's hand and the playing of the percussion instruments. Another thing very similar to that is that usually the string section, which is the largest part of the orchestra, is laid out first violins, second violins, and on the other side of the stage, violas and cellos, with basses in the back behind the cellos. And in the first rehearsals and performances of the desert music in Cologne, what I had immediately taken as a challenge in the desert music was to divide up the string section into three parts, which were playing against each other polyrhythmically, just as I'd been doing in all of my music right along. The string players found this very hard to do. And here I was in a situation of like, gosh, the most important thing I want them to do is the hardest thing for them to do. What to do about it? Well, in Cologne, there was no time to do anything about it. And it simply happened and didn't happen very well. In New York, when the Brooklyn Academy gave me 36 hours of rehearsal with Michael Tilson Thomas, I very wisely divided the rehearsal in two, 18 hours in September, 18 hours in October. We had the same problem in September, but this time I had a chance to think about it and talk with string players. They said, why don't you reseat us? So we now have in the seating diagram of the piece, and as a kind of general operative for me in general when I write for orchestras, I divide the strings up into two or three groups depending on what it is they have to play. First, second, viola, cello, bass, one, two, three, left, right, and center. Then when they bow together as they're used to doing, following the principal player in the section and working as a unit, just as I might have in my own ensemble, against the other unit, against the third unit. And this was like magic. It made these things possible to play because it became idiomatic to the way they play. Now, this is standing me in very, very good stead right now, this kind of simple but very important change in seating and deployment and thinking in the piece I'm writing for the St. Louis Symphony, which will be done in April in St. Louis, and April 3rd in St. Louis, and April 11th at Carnegie Hall in New York.
Do you find that symphonic musicians require a certain sensitivity to your music in order to actually play it?
Yes, but the good news is that I'm getting older and they're getting younger. when I used to go to orchestra concerts, everybody looked like grandpa. Then they began looking like daddy, and now they're beginning to look like my brother or my son. So as I approach 50, they seem to be zonking in on 35. I mean, a short story that says it all is as follows. I went out to San Francisco about a couple of years ago, and John Adams was going to conduct Tehillim with the members of the San Francisco Symphony. And also on the program was a piece that's a real ensemble piece of mine, music for mallet instruments, voices, and organ. And I had sent out, I had two separate sets of parts. One is a part for my ensemble where I have the four marimba players playing on two marimbas, so two guys are standing facing each other. One of them is on the, quote, wrong side of the instrument. But I have four separate parts for straight players to play. So I went out there and started rehearsal. I wasn't playing. I stand anyway, and I see the two principal players are facing each other over the marimba. So I kind of figured what was going on, but I played dumb, and I went up. I said, excuse me, aren't you in the wrong position? And he looked at me and he said, we know what you guys do, and it's more fun that way. I did not know this gentleman. He must have been about, 28 or 32, somewhere in there. And I could have danced the jig. I was so happy to hear that. And the playing was right there.
That's great.
And this is, I find this, the principal player, Mitchell Peters in Los Angeles, knows just how to play my music too. And it's just happening.
Did you get any strange reactions from your friends in the art world when your performance, when your performances and your music started to reach wider audiences and you were being written up in Time magazine?
Well, my friends in the art world were also reaching wider audiences, and Richard Serra was having his troubles with the press, and people like Bruce Nauman are appreciated all around the world, and Michael Snow has kind of kept a very low profile, but most of the people that I knew, were doing very well, so I could have said, what are you doing up there, too? I mean, Time, this didn't happen in 3 days or even in 3 years, so I don't think that any of those, there may be some people who felt that I was doing better music in that period. I don't doubt it. But, that's the way of the world. There are going to be people who like a certain period of any artist.
Was there ever a period where you thought, my music's becoming trendy? I don't mean that what you were writing was becoming trendy, but it was spawning a trend that there were all these imitators out copying you and, being inspired by you, but sometimes out and out copying you.
There's almost an academic minimal thing going on now, which all goes to prove that you can make nothing out of something, and it always happens in the world, and that's simply the way things are. First, you're considered a lunatic, and then you're considered, maybe there's something there, and then pretty soon it becomes an academic pursuit and if you like, a trend. And certain aspects of it have been wonderful. If I can influence and get credit for influencing someone like John Adams, I'm delighted that, that I can give somebody who's as talented as that, or Arvo Pärt, the Latvian, now living in Berlin, who I met in New York and told me, that he heard my music in Russia. Because Arvo Pärt is his own man. He's really doing something. John Adams is clearly his own man. And if I can influence people like that, I feel wonderful. I feel proud that I've been able to have a positive effect on the world. If Brian Eno or David Bowie says something nice about music and they can get something out of it similarly. And as for the others, that's the way the world is. 90% of it is junk no matter where you look.
What are some of the strangest places that you've heard your influences turning up in musically?
Well, I guess in certain rock groups and in academia, the two extremes, bad rock and bad academics.
Is there always music going around your head?
No. Sometimes there is, sometimes there isn't. Usually the piece that I'm writing is going around in my head because I'm figuring out what comes next. And I do work in an instrument, but there's an interplay between what goes on in your head and what goes on when you're sitting at the instrument.
Your new piece, Desert Music, is going to be performed in Philadelphia, and it's also recently been released on record. We talked about it a little bit before, but I'd like to talk about it in a little more depth now. It has a text by William Carlos Williams.
Right.
What attracted you to the particular text that you used?
Good question. Well, Williams is someone that I read since I was, 16 or 17, walked into a bookshop and saw a book by a man whose name read more or less the same backwards and forwards, so I picked it up. And it turned out to be Patterson, and I really couldn't make a great deal of sense out of what I read, but there was something in it that kept me reading. And I kept reading him. This is like in the early or middle 50s. I was at Cornell. He came up to read. I heard him read. I was very impressed with that. I began reading Ezra Pound and the people who lived in his Marion Moore, people who he was associated with. And I came to love Williams as a poet and admire him as a human being. He was a full-time doctor in New Jersey. He knew that he should stay in America when Pound and Eliot and Hemingway went to Europe. He knew that his inspiration was lying in the speech that he heard on the streets of Rutherford, Passaic, New Jersey. He was a man who composed a huge body of work while being a full-time physician in the days of the little black bag and you go to their house. I had tried to set him as a student and always felt when I was setting him that somehow I was killing the poetry by setting it. It's like setting an insect in amber and there they are, dead as a doornail. And I put it aside, figuring, I'm just not up to this yet. Williams always said, and it was true, that his poetry came out of the way we speak, the irregularities, the shifts of accent that are natural American speech. And to capture that in a fixed meter, whether it's 4 or 6 or 3, is to kill it. In any event, I read a lot of other poets later on, people like Robert Creeley, even Allen Ginsberg, Ed Dorn, Philip Whalen, people of the what we call the Black Mountain School who came out of Williams's influence, I would think Charles Olson. but I didn't really do a great deal about it. When the desert music was commissioned by Cologne and then the Brooklyn Academy of Music, I thought of various things. I thought I was going to set Ludwig Wittgenstein in the original German. I thought I was going to use recordings of Hitler's voice or recordings of Harry Truman announcing he was going to drop the A-bomb. But I ended up going back to Williams and reading almost his entire work, looking for what I was going to use, and I ended up settling on stuff that was written at the end of his life. Because I liked it the best. It seemed that Williams is one of those artists who gets more and more lucid as they get older. He could be very opaque when he was younger, and he could also be sort of slightly folky. As he got older, he got very eloquent, very direct, and very moving. And the poems I selected were from a book called The Desert Music. There is a poem called The Desert Music I didn't use. The central text that I use is from a poem called The Orchestra, and it mostly talks about music. But in the middle of a poem about music, written in three-line stanzas, there's three lines of prose written justified on both sides, as if the doctor was at his prescription pad writing a piece of poem and looked you up straight in the eye and said, say to them, man has survived hitherto because he was too ignorant to know how to realize his wishes. Now that he can realize them, he must either change them or perish. Now, what is that doing in a poem about the orchestra? Now, I can't give you a simple answer, but it absolutely magnetized me, and I decided that I would set that. And that somehow took care of the Hitler speeches and the Truman speeches and the multimedia collage works that were floating around my mind. Somehow this is more eloquent and more what I could deal with. And the other line that's in the orchestra also, that is perhaps the emblem of the whole piece to me, says, well, shall we think or listen? Is there a sound addressed not wholly to the ear? We half close our eyes. We do not hear it through our eyes. It is not a flute note either. It is the relation of a flute note to a drum. I am wide awake. The mind is listening. At which point in the piece the chorus sings, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee-dee. Sort of leaves the world of discourse entirely, turns its back on the listener, so to speak. Setting Williams sort of felt like realizing something I'd wanted to do all my life. And because of Tehillim, because of these little groups of twos and threes, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, which was something that just popped into my head when I was studying the Hebrew, and which I thought was the way I heard Hebrew, lo and behold, when I was thinking of, well, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, shall we? I found I was also doing it with English. And I thought, aha, this is how I hear speech. And I thought, aha, this is also, there's no mathematical schema here. It's not two and three to fit any mathematical rule whatsoever. It's two and three to fit the various syllabic stress that my ear hears in the language. Now, as Sam Irwin said, English is my mother tongue. I'm a master of it. And I felt that this was the key to setting Williams. These little groups of twos and threes gave the slight unpredictable stress that, while it may not have been what Williams had in mind, was a way of dealing with the way his poetry really is. So I felt, aha, that's it. I've got a handle on this thing technically. And since the poetry was something that I had loved and was very emotionally attached to, it set off, and I must say remained, an inspired piece. I can think of no other word.
Because he uses an idiomatic kind of speech and a direct, you know, speech, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of language. Did you find the lines of your music changing in that
yes.
way too?
Well, they changed very much from movement to movement depending on what's being said. At the beginning of the piece, the chorus is not singing Williams at all. It's singing dee, 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 dee. It's the chorus is part of the orchestra. And one of the things that the piece is about, one of the main things the piece is about, is what happens when you're setting a text. Well, you know, as we're talking, you can hear what we're talking about. You can also hear that I speak very quickly, that I sound have a New York accent, and you perceive who I am according to the character of my voice. That's a very valid, true way we live. When the chorus is inside the orchestra, they lend a life to the sound, which you wouldn't get without them, but they're not singing words. It's another way of them communicating, of being singers. It's called vocalese. It has a name in the tradition. Ravel uses it in Daphnis and Chloe. Then there's a setting of begin. Begin, my friend, for you cannot, you may be sure, take your song, which drives all things out of mind with you to the other world, which is the translation of Theocritus. And that is set first repeating, begin, begin, my friend, begin, begin, my friend, begin. It's like running back and forth on a diving board, but aha, this time you finally jump off the diving board into the pool, because then it goes, for you cannot, etc. It goes through the rest of the text once, period. To the end, and goes on to the next movement, which is, well, shall we think or listen? Then you have the text that I mentioned first, Say to the Man Who Survived Hitherto. This is set absolutely clearly, middle register, half notes and whole notes, terribly focused, and I hope very audible, which is followed by the very center of the piece where the text says, it is the principle of music to repeat the theme. repeats and repeat again as the pace mounts. The theme is difficult, but no more difficult than the facts to be resolved. Now, this is presented once as a little tune and immediately is turned into canons. The first one, it is a principle of music to repeat the theme. It is a principle. It is a principle. And once this gets going in three voices at once, with piccolos on top and tubas on the bottom, it just turns into syllables, which is what I wanted it to do. It's self-referential. It's a little ironic. It's verging on nonsense. It does very definitely mean something. And in the middle of the piece, in this very section, you get to canons on the word difficult, 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 where the text is there, but it kind of disappears into the world of sound. So what happens in the desert music in terms of the text is that some of the text is set absolutely straightforwardly, some of it is set so canonically that it begins to disappear, and some of the text is not text at all. It's pure vocalese. You go the full range.
Do you think your background as a drummer has made you a much more rhythmically conscious composer?
Whatever it was that made me be a drummer is still with me, thank God. And I hope it'll be with me till I'm put in a box and shipped away. So I think that that's an essential part of my musical personality, absolutely.
You know, it strikes me that if your instrument is the drums and mm-hmm. your background is in classical music, you'd better be a composer because there's not a lot of call for drumming in most orchestras.
Well, even the percussion literature really gets underway in the 20th century in any serious way, and that's true. And that happens to people who study percussion always become contemporary music players. Everybody says, why? Simple. The literature is there, and it's not there in the earlier centuries. You have a little timpani part, that's it. The rest are decorative little timbrel touches, bass drum here, cymbal there. But the real meat and potatoes literature starts in the 20th century.
You're an avant-gardist who it's now okay to play in an orchestra, right? Do you think of yourself as being like the safe member of the avant-garde now?
No, I don't generally use that kind of thinking, and I certainly wouldn't want to be safe. I would certainly want to be very, very good, i.e. people get some joy out of the music, which is finally what anybody is left with. I think that those kinds of considerations that you bring up are things that are brought up, but that they sort of pale after a while as, I don't know, people get older and all that becomes irrelevant. And what you're left with is I love it or I don't love it. And if that can remain through all the various flack that's always flying around your head at the focus, and then you just might be in good shape.
And I guess you love the idea that your music is reacted to viscerally and not just intellectually.
If it isn't really a pleasure, then it's my fault, and I'm sorry.
Well, I've really taken great pleasure in hearing your music, and I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.